The Link, Michael Annesley. Stout Mynheer Leibschitz came and went, much at his own sweet will, between his home at Zutphen and the towns of western Germany which lie reasonably close to the frontier of the Netherlands. His unfailing kindliness endeared him to his fellow Dutchmen. He was well-liked in Germany for a certain quiet, concentrated hatred of the British, which he had harboured since receiving in the Boer War a bullet wound which still caused him to walk with a pronounced limp. In the spring of 1914, an accident had laid him abed for some weeks, and then, despite his hatred of the British, he had gone to London for treatment. Certain high officials at the Marineamt smiled knowingly when they heard that story, for there had been occasions when Paul Leibschitz had rendered valuable service to the German intelligence department. Some weeks prior to the outbreak of the Great War, he returned to the house in which he lived alone at Zutphen and resumed his journeys into Germany. But even after the outbreak of hostilities, the frontier guards, Dutch and German alike, paid but the most perfunctory attention to his comings and goings. Quite a number of people took to visiting him at outrageous hours of the night, but he showed no signs of annoyance at being thus disturbed, and more often than not, after his mysterious visitors had departed, took a stroll to the loft, where lived the carrier pigeons which had provided him with a hobby for quite a number of years. His business seemed to be conducted mainly in Dortmund, Essen, and Düsseldorf, but sometimes he went as far as Cologne, and very occasionally to Berlin. In the German capital, he ceased to be the provincial businessman and became the intimate of important people in government circles. For the first few months of the war, the luck was with him, although the character he bore was entirely different on opposite sides of the frontier. In Germany, he was regarded as a valuable Secret Service agent, for news that came from him regarding the plans of the Allies was always reliable, although not so invariably useful. But, as he explained, it was not always possible to send information as promptly as he would wish to do so. In Holland, he had not yet attracted the attention of the Dutch government, for he continued to play to perfection the part of an industrious businessman. Early in 1915, he left Zutphen, presumably because the frequent visits paid by women to his lonely house at night had scandalized his fellow townsmen. The real cause of his removal to a small office in Rotterdam may have been a hint dropped by one of his furtive visitors that certain people in Berlin were growing suspicious and might take steps to interrogate him the next time he should cross the frontier. Once he was in Rotterdam, it did not take Paul Leibschitz long to find out who were the heads of the various counter-espionage services located in the city. As a Dutch neutral, he had no difficulty in making friends with most of them, and having taken up his residence at the Maas Hotel, which was overrun with German agents, he re-established himself with the Berlin authorities by keeping up a regular supply of accurate information, which would have been invaluable had it arrived in time, or had not the British authorities changed their plans at the last moment, or taken steps to forestall any possible source of leakage. Up to that time, it had been surprisingly easy for the British, Belgian, and French secret services to get information out of Belgium on account of the hundreds of Belgian refugees who had settled in Holland. But shortly after the arrival of Paul Leibschitz in Rotterdam, Germany created a singularly effective barrier against the passage of information by erecting a deadly high-voltage wire fence along the Dutch-Belgian frontier. This fence was guarded by a cordon of sentries, each within sight of the other, and further was constantly patrolled by German secret police in plain clothes. The erection of this barrier put a period to the activities of both Dutch and Belgian freelance agents, but from some mysterious British headquarters in Rotterdam, lines radiated to courier centres for frontier agents at Terneuzen, Tilburg and Eindhoven in Holland, and were carried on to Maastricht in Belgium. People were established as letterboxes in Belgium at Waterbeke, Brussels, Antwerp and Liège. There were a dozen frontier passages. Boatmen bore messages along the rivers Scheldt and Meuse. The habitual smugglers below Sittard brought information out of Germany, and but few of the promeneurs, passeurs and train watchers sent into Belgium to gather information regarding German activities were apprehended for a time. The success of the British organisation puzzled not only the hostile but also the Allied counter-espionage services in Holland. The Hauptmann von Eberfeldt invited Paul Leibschitz to dine with him. "Mynheer," said the head of the German counter-espionage service in Holland, "you have in the past rendered valuable services to my country." "For which I have been paid most generously," smiled the Dutchman. Von Eberfeldt acknowledged the interruption with a stiff little bow. "There are greater rewards to be earned," he said with a hint of sarcasm. this Herr Walford, now, whom we all know to be acting in the interests of England, you might become more intimate with him.
It would be difficult, Leibschitz faltered. I have not troubled to hide my hatred of the British.
But you have not quarreled with him?
No.
Then cultivate him. We will pay well for information leading to the destruction of his organization. Tom Walford received a call from Paul Leibschitz upon the following morning, and the men remained closeted together for a long time. Thereafter, the same sort of people, and particularly women, who had come to his house at Zutphen by night, began frequenting the office of Paul Leibschitz in Rotterdam, and, incidentally, several bargees, who, besides conveying food to the Dutch and American relief organizations in Belgium and France along the many canals, had been in the habit of conveying valuable information collected by promeneurs, were caught red-handed and promptly executed. Von Eberfeldt was proud of the inspiration which had led him to enlist the help of the limping Leibschitz. Letterboxes, too, were identified. Basseur were caught, and further executions followed. Nevertheless, the efficiency of the British counter-espionage organization remained unimpaired. Among the women agents who visited Leibschitz was a certain Clotilde Brun, of whom at first he was suspicious because of a vague sense of familiarity which her personality aroused. It was a sensation so indefinite that he could not for the life of him remember whether he had seen her before in London or Berlin, although he was virtually certain that they had met previously in one or other of those cities. Clotilde, for her part, proved reticent or gave evasive answers to his guarded questions. Apart from the excellent work she did for him, he could not make the girl out. There was something of mystery and a certain haunting sadness about her. Many of the best female agents in the various secret services were no better than prostitutes, but Clotilde Brun quite definitely did not come into that category. She had a quaint air of virginal sanctity, which seemed to be strangely at variance with the profession she had adopted. She did not appear to have become a spy through motives of patriotism, for she would confess to no nationality, and had upon occasion asserted laughingly that she owed allegiance to no particular country. For a time, Leibschitz suspected her of being of that most dangerous type, the international spy, who had no loyalty and is always ready to sell information to the highest bidder. Nevertheless, the girl served him well, often obtained the most valuable information, and thus gradually gained both his confidence and his liking. Despite these circumstances, Clotilde herself could not make up her mind which side her employer was serving. For Paul Leibschitz was exceedingly clever, and although he demanded information from her of troop movements in Belgium, he gave her messages just as frequently to pass on to the German high command. The playing of this double game on his part enabled her to come and go between Holland and Germany and Belgium by the frontier passages which her employer no longer used. It was the capture of another of his agents, a 16-year-old Belgian girl named Marie, which finally revealed to Clotilde the true nature of her employer's allegiance. Marie had proved the best type of agent since she was 14, for she was fired by a veritable Jeanne d'Arc spirit of patriotism, and, moreover, her rosy peasant cheeks and innocent blue eyes had endeared her to the old family men of the German Landsturm troops who guarded the deadly high-voltage fence delimiting the frontier. By making particular friends with one of these old German soldiers, to whom she often took little dainties from her mother's kitchen, Marie had been able to get messages to a man in Vachterbecker, who subsequently furnished valuable information as to a big concentration of German troops in the Vachterbecker-Moorbecker-Lockeren sector. The divisions making the concentration were from the Polish marches, and it was vitally important to find out what purpose they were to be used on the Western Front. Marie was carrying the required report from the man at Vachterbecker, cleverly concealed on her person, when she was caught in the Zelsat sector by a German plainclothes secret service man. The evidence against the child was damningly complete. Leibschitz was appalled when he heard of the capture. He had often spoken to the child without letting her have a notion of who he was, and apart from that, had felt an abounding admiration for her resourcefulness and courage. His first generous instinct was to slip across the frontier and to contrive her escape at any cost. Cool consideration brought wiser counsels, for Leibschitz was, in reality, chief of the British counter-espionage service in Holland. As such, his life was worth the lives of many agents, for upon his genius the success of that organization depended. Remove him suddenly, and the whole edifice he had so carefully erected would collapse like a house of cards. To make matters worse, he was far from being unaware of how closely he had been watched of late by recognized German agents in Rotterdam. He had a habit of limping about the streets, markets, and harbors of the city, stopping here to gaze into a shop window that was being redressed, halting there to finger and perhaps rearrange the wares displayed upon some open stall, where he would sit drinking in dockside taverns with sailors and stevedores, sometimes for hours on end. After such excursions, he would work patiently behind the locked door of his room far into the night with a thin codebook open at his elbow. Lately, all his actions had been carefully observed, and once the door of his room had been tried stealthily while he was hard at work, but the passage beyond had been empty by the time he got the door open. No, it certainly would not do for him to enter any territory that was in German occupation, and so he sent for Clotilde Brun.
Clotilde, he said quietly, a catastrophe has befallen. Marie has been captured. She is but a child, and yet was one of our best passeurs.
Clotilde dropped her eyes, lest the man should see the gleam of excited interest which must have shone in them.
Marie, a Belgian, eh? She queried.
A Belgian refugee, he agreed.
Then you really are fucking against Germany.
Does it matter for whom we work, he countered, so long as both of us are well paid.
Not in the least, she shrugged. What do you want me to do?
Paul Leibschitz leaned eagerly across the table.
Will you slip to the frontier passage at Zelzat and go to Wachterbecker, he said. Go to the last house but one in the village, and if you see a flower pot in the window, it will be safe for you to approach M29. He will tell you where Marie is imprisoned. Contrive her escape if you can. If that is not possible, use every means in your power to get her sentence commuted to imprisonment. They are pretty well certain to sentence her to death in the first place, for she was caught red-handed.
Very good,
said Clotilde Brun, and left her employer abruptly. A fortnight later, Paul Leibschitz received a message from M29 to the effect that the death sentence passed on Marie had been commuted to one of imprisonment for the duration of the war, but of Clotilde he received no word. That Clotilde Brun had been able to arrange matters thus satisfactorily was not in the least surprising. After taking the precaution of satisfying herself as to the identity of M29, the unfortunate man was shot in the cold of a grey dawn a fortnight later. She had stayed only for a short interview with the officer commanding the German troops before going straight through to Berlin. Old Count von Reichhofen, chief of the intelligence department, received her in friendly fashion, for he knew that she would not have risked making the journey unless she had urgent information of the most important character to convey.
Well, Count, she said. I've got what you wanted. The head of the British Secret Service in Holland is our pseudo-spy, Meneer Paul Leibschitz.
Paul Leibschitz? Impossible, cried the Count. Why, he risked his life by going to London to get the most valuable information about the British Navy. Besides, he has sent us much accurate information since then.
Clotilde crossed her silk-clad legs and lit a cigarette with slow deliberation.
Information that would have been valuable if it had reached you in time, or if the British had not altered their plans so opportunely for themselves,
she corrected.
I think Leibschitz has changed a great deal since he returned from London.
You mean?
A change of heart. He's the same man, right enough, if one may go by the various portraits with which you provided me.
But Fraulein, protested Reichhofen.
Clotilde crushed out her cigarette, and tapping out each point upon the edge of the great man's desk with the tip of a slender forefinger, she set out, detail by detail, the evidence she had collected against Paul Leibschitz, right down to the damning corroboration of his own inferred admissions, supported by the orders he had given her concerning the child spy named Marie. After an hour or more had passed, the Count sat back, convinced at last.
So?
His breath escaped in a gusty sigh and his fists clenched savagely.
So, he must be enticed into Belgium or Germany and dealt with. Will you be the pretty bait, mein Liebchen?
Gladly, Count, replied Clotilde. But can things be arranged just so simply?
You mean?
Meneer Leibschitz is a Dutch subject whose hatred of the British is well known in his own country. Also, there may be evidence in existence that he has served the fatherland. Too many deal with him in our own land, or for trespassing in occupied territory, for cause bad feeling in Holland, unless it could be proved that he was caught red-handed.
Then you suggest what?
Clotilde uncrossed her legs and folded her arms upon the desk as she leaned forward. Her great eyes blazed into the brooding ones of Karl von Reichhofen.
He has a fondness for me, she murmured. If he believed I was in danger, he might come. But that would not supply such evidence as would convict him to the satisfaction of his own people. Give me leave to finish, my commandant. 1,000 pardons, Fraulein. You were saying? I was about to tell you that Paul Leibschitz is moving heaven and earth to discover for what purpose the divisions are to be used that have come back from the Russian front to the Vachterbecker-Moorbecker-Lockeren area. If he could be persuaded that I am in danger because I have obtained and am prepared to hand over to him a copy of the orders for the disposition of those newly arrived divisions, then I think he would come to me in any place I care to name.
Splendid! Cried the Count, thumping the desk. A special set of plausible but entirely false orders shall be prepared at once. The beautiful spy smiled a slow, contemptuous smile.
You underrate the intelligence and the extensive knowledge of this man, my commandant. He is himself an expert in supplying nearly true or too late authentic information. If I am to go through with this business, you must entrust me with the real orders, or none at all.
But suppose he snatches them from you and makes off at once, protested von Reichhoffen.
He is too chivalrous. I shall meet him at a house I know of in Vachterbecker. M-29, the agent who occupies it, can be removed just before Leibschitz is due to arrive, and a certain flowerpot will be standing in the window. There I shall play the lovesick maiden, who, to induce him to stay the night, will not give up the orders until her passion for him is satiated.
But, broke in the chief of intelligence.
Oh, I know all about my enviable reputation for chastity,
smiled Clotilda.
Do not worry about me. I can look after myself. Have the house surrounded and let your men enter when I remove the flower pot from the window. I want time to find out as much as possible about the organization he has created.
Thus were matters arranged, and hence when Paul Leibschitz was becoming really anxious over the prolonged absence of Clotilda Brun, a message was passed on to him in all innocence by M-29. The message was remarkably cryptic, but cleverly conveyed its meaning to the man who held the main clue, and was, moreover, not unused to the deepest kind of cogitation. Once he understood the situation and realized that Clotilda was being hunted for her life, the effect upon Paul Leibschitz was remarkable. Although in the case of a younger man, with the hot blood of youth flowing fast in his veins, it might have been easily understandable. In the first shock of receiving such news, the fact that the girl was in possession of the all-important move or operation orders for the German divisions which had been released from the Russian front made no appreciable impression upon his mind. All he thought of was the fragrant sweetness of Clotilda as he had known, and not, he feared, appreciated her. Even that vague familiarity, that feeling of having known her elsewhere, which had caused him to distrust her slightly, was forgotten. By reason of his Secret Service training, however, the subsidiary, but from considerations of duty, far more important information contained in the message at last claimed his attention. He would have liked to get in touch again with M-29 before moving, but that was impossible because the message fixed a rendezvous for the next night at the last house but one in the main street of Vachterbecker. Wherefore Paul Leibschitz laid his plans as carefully as possible, and after dusk upon the following evening slipped across the Dutch border by the frontier passage at Zelzat, hard by the place where little Marie had been apprehended. The night was intensely dark, and a blinding rainstorm lashed piteously across the flat fields over which the man, disguised as a peasant whom no one would have recognized as Paul Leibschitz, trudged doggedly. Surprisingly enough, his habitual limp had disappeared. That limp, in fact, lay buried in the grave of the real Paul Leibschitz, who had faced a firing squad one morning in that tragic little rifle range at the grim old Tower of London. The British agent who had taken the dead Dutchman's place arrived at the rendezvous in Vachterbecker a full hour before the time appointed. The expected shadow of the flowerpot showed against the lamplit blind of the living room, and the door was unlatched. But to the British agent's no small annoyance, M-29 was absent. Said the man who had been known as Leibschitz. Whether he's here or not doesn't much matter. I've an hour in which to make myself both comfortable and presentable before Clotilda arrives. After locking the front door of the cottage, he rummaged through the scullery for some time before unearthing an ancient wash-tub. He had already set 2 kettles and 4 saucepans full of water upon the fire he had made up. Then he went back to the living room for the rush basket in which he had carried, wrapped in a ground sheet, a suit of clothes suitable for the portly figure of Mynheer Leibschitz, together with sundry parcels of padding. As he stooped to take up the basket, he noticed for the first time a dull stain which was soaking brownly into the floorboards. That stain was wet to the touch, and the mark it left upon his questing finger was sticky and red, not brown. A low whistle of surprise escaped from the man's lips. Then, quickly, he hid the rush basket and its contents in the grate of an unlighted copper. It is noteworthy that he lay close to hand while he took his bath a heavy revolver which was fitted with a silencer. It may appear strange that in the circumstances he showed no signs of panic, but as he saw things, if M-29 had been caught and killed that night in the living room adjoining, the man's murderers would by this time have taken their departure, well satisfied with their night's work, in which case Clotilda would find the coast well clear. If, on the other hand, his own advent had been anticipated, the house most certainly would be surrounded already, so that there would be no possible harm in comforting his cold body by means of a hot bath. The one eventuality for which he did not legislate was the arrival of Clotilda some time in advance of the hour of their assignation, and Clotilda, anxious to make sure that the removal of M-29 had been carried out without too much disturbance, came to the cottage within a few minutes of the man she had known as Leibschitz completing his bath. Turning the well-oiled lock with a skeleton key, she entered the dark living room without making a sound. At once she became aware of a light in the scullery where someone was singing softly. One glimpse she had of the back view of a lean, hard body, and then she saw reflected in a mirror hung upon the scullery wall the features of a face that she had never forgotten. Slowly, the blood drained from her cheeks, leaving her pale and swaying slightly, for she was half stifled by the tumultuous beating of her heart, which at first had seemed to stand still for an age-long while. Very quietly she crept out again into the howling gale to wait patiently, despite the driving rain and tearing wind, until a light sprang up in the cottage living room. Then she advanced and knocked four times on the door in a manner which would be recognized by M-29 or his master. The man who opened to her was Mynheer Leibschitz to the very life. So wonderful indeed was the make-up that Clotilda was almost tempted to rub her eyes. No one, however, knew better than she what a marvellous alteration can be made in the appearance of a person by the use of rubber pads held in the cheeks, plasticine to alter the shape of the nose, and padding to increase the girth of an otherwise good figure.
"Ah, my dear Clotilda, I am glad to see you,"
she was welcomed, and the voice had the slight thick oleaginousness that one associates with the voices of fat men who will never again see 50.
"I have come to meet you, of course, but the long tramp across those infernally heavy fields between here and Zelzat has made me more lame than ever."
Clotilda was watching him closely, trying to detect in the Mynheer Leibschitz who stood before her some trace of that Jim Lockton whom she had known long years ago in London, and whose face she had seen again for one fleeting instant reflected in a mirror that very night. But neither in features, form, nor voice could she detect one single resemblance to the man she had known and loved in the long ago. For one wild moment she almost believed that both Leibschitz and Lockton had been in the cottage together, and that Jim had departed by the back door while the other had remained. She had almost believed, that is, until she remembered that the small dwelling was entirely surrounded by soldiers of those troops from the Russian front, the orders for whose operations the British agent had crossed the frontier to secure.
"Well," queried Leibschitz, "why do you look at me so strangely, Clotilda?"
"Oh," she murmured brokenly, "why did you come?"
And before he could answer her, she pushed him into the room and, turning, locked the door. Not satisfied with that, she shot home the bolts at top and bottom and would have closed the shutters also, but dared not remove the flower pot from the window ledge.
"There, there, my dear," he soothed and placed his hand affectionately upon her shoulder.
At his touch she trembled like a frightened filly, and again a low, distressful moan broke from her lips.
"Why, Clotilda," he continued, "this is not like you. We're perfectly safe, my dear. Of what are you afraid? I've brought food with me. Let us eat it while we wait for the storm to blow itself out, and then we'll slip back home to Holland. I'm beginning to think that you've just about played your part in this game of ours."
"Too fell," she answered bitterly. "I've played my part too fell."
His eyes clouded suddenly, for he remembered that sinister stain upon the floor and wondered if she had betrayed M-29. But the question he put concerned the plans he had been led to believe that she would bring to their rendezvous.
"The operation orders for the divisions from the Russian front are safe," she answered. "It is you who are in danger. Before we talk of that, however, tell me one thing truly, Paul. Are you the international spy you have tried to make me believe you to be, or do you honestly serve England?"
Why, whatever difference does it make? He smiled.
Just all the difference in the world, Paul, she answered. For a time I mistook you for a double agent, fancied that you were pretending to serve the Allies, but in reality were working for Germany. The fact that the information you sent to Berlin was accurate, but as a rule useless, first made me suspicious of you. The affair of Marie opened my eyes a good deal wider.
And so? Questioned Jim Lockton.
And so I went to Berlin and told my story to the chief of the intelligence department.
Jim Lockton's glittering eyes looked hard as agate, and his hand closed upon the butt of the revolver in his pocket.
Then you have been working for Germany all the time, he asserted.
As you have been working for England, she countered. But I have this justification, that my mother was a German by birth.
Slowly the hand that held the revolver emerged from Jim Lockton's pocket, but the sight of the weapon, which would make no sound that might be heard above the raging of the storm, did not alarm Clotilda.
There's no need for that, Paul, she said wearily. The house is surrounded, and there can be no escape unless...
The girl faltered, and the man cut in harshly. Unless what? You know the penalty for betrayal in the game we play.
That doesn't matter, Isa. But I've been thinking, remembering things, perhaps, and so I've changed my mind.
Too late, perhaps.
The words were charged with sarcasm, but there was an infinite sweetness in the woman's answering smile.
Listen, Paul, she said, for I want you to understand my motives. I have hated England because my father was cashiered unjustly, as I think, and shot himself. The shock killed my mother, and as I was left almost destitute, I went to London. I could get no work, for I had no qualifications, and so the easy road for a penniless girl lay open. I used to frequent a place in Glasshouse Street. But before the fatal first step was taken, a strange thing happened. One night I went to Folkestone with three or four foreigners who had pestered me before and were very set upon making me drunk so that my downfall could be accomplished. It would not have been difficult anyway, for the last of my small store of money was finished.
She paused for a moment, brooding eyes looking back into the past. The man stirred restlessly, for now he was able to interpret that vague feeling of familiarity he had always experienced in her presence.
I was saved, she went on, by a certain Jim Lockton, whom I knew very slightly. He was in the Folkestones that night and called me over to him. Then he would have left the place the foreigners interfered, and there was a fight. Oh, but he was splendid, she cried, clasping her hands.
Well, what happened afterwards? Did he keep you? Queried the man.
Ah, no, she answered. He wasn't that sort. He would have helped me with money, perhaps, but the very next day I obtained a post as nursery governess in the family of a German officer who was returning to Berlin. From that, I drifted easily into the German secret service. You see, I am such a good linguist and something of an actress. Now I've made up my mind to repay the debt I owe to the memory of Jim Lockton.
How?
The question came harshly, but there was a certain tenderness lurking somewhere at the back of the man's eyes.
Listen, Paul, she answered eagerly. The plan was to trap you here with the operation orders for the divisions from the Russian front in your possession.
The real orders? He demanded urgently.
Yes, yes, you shall have some, Paul, but don't interrupt. I was to drug you, and the soldiers who are waiting were to enter when I removed the flower pot from the window ledge. They cannot know who is here, although they have your description, for they were not posted when I arrived. You must change your appearance as much as possible, Paul, and leave quite openly. If you are questioned, you can tell them that I have sent you away because I am waiting for someone else, but you must conceal your lameness.
That can be managed, Jim Lockton answered thoughtfully, and added, but what will happen to you?
For a barely perceptible fraction of a second, she hesitated.
Why, how dull you are, Paul, she laughed. I shall tell them, of course, that you never came, and presently I shall join you in Rotterdam.
Good, said he, and perhaps there will be a surprise prepared against your arrival. I think that you and this Jim Lockton ought to meet again.
At last Clotilda saw the light in his eyes and knew that happiness, such as she had never experienced, was very near. But the rest of the road was yet to tread. Well, she knew that her every movement had been watched that night, that the arrival of the man believed to be Leibschitz had, in all human probability, been observed. On the other hand, she argued, the troops would be likely to let any other person pass who might leave the cottage, since they had not been given definite orders neither to act nor to interfere until the flower pot was removed from the window. wherefore she lied bravely, looking him straight in the eyes, and so, presently, persuaded him to go into the scullery and make ready for his return journey. The slim young peasant who emerged in due course was like neither Leibschitz nor Jim Lockton, and he did not limp. The complete metamorphosis was incredible, and Clotilda eyed the stranger with almost professional approval. Jim's eyes, however, were fixed eagerly upon the thin sheets of typewritten orders she had laid on the table. The girl would have hastened him away at once, but he would not take the orders with him, so sat down to commit them to memory before burning the document. This was fortunate, for subsequently he was most thoroughly searched before being allowed to pass through the cordon of troops that encircled the cottage. At last, when he bade goodbye to Clotilda, it seemed for a moment that he would take her into his arms, but that moment passed unused. Perhaps there lingered in his mind some doubt of her sincerity. Perhaps he imagined fondly, not knowing what she was, that any present revelation of his true personality would make parting too hard. In any case, he went his way, leaving unspoken the words which had trembled on his tongue. Through the rest of that night, Clotilda sat staring into the glowing embers of a dying fire, nothing heeding and nothing needing, living only in her memories. At dawn, the officer commanding the troops knocked heavily upon the door. Clotilda made one brave attempt to bluff her way out of the desperate situation, but the Count von Reichhofen, never quite trusting her, had told the officer a great deal more than she suspected. The arrival overnight of the man who called himself Leibschitz had been observed, and that circumstance, combined with her inability to produce the all-important operation orders, sealed her fate. In Rotterdam, Jim Lockton waited with what patience he could summon, but hope waned as the weeks went by. M-29 was dead, the frontier passage at Zelzat closed, and so the war was ended before he learned for certain of the execution of the woman who had taken the name of Clotilda Brune.